Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Tech and E-commerce podcast. I'm your host, Rushit Shah, and I'm also Regional Director at Elcott Global, responsible for executive search and consulting business in Asia Pacific. Our mission is to connect the tech in supply chain and e-commerce ecosystem globally by bringing forward some of the interesting stories about success and failures from leaders in industry.
I'm very excited for today's episode as we have John Hafter, founder of Threshio. They are the leader in buying up and scaling third-party merchant, selling on Amazon and other marketplace platforms. John has witnessed and grown the company of 4 into 1,000 person. They are valued at $10 billion and hopefully will be 11 by the time this podcast is out. John, welcome to the podcast series and we are happy to have you.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. John, we'll take it easy. Our audience is really keen to learn how did the idea of Threshio originated and how did you become part of it?
That's funny. Yeah, no, I like telling these stories mainly because I too like a good origin story. You know, whenever you watch like one of those Marvel movies or something, I'm actually always most fascinated in it's like Peter Parker before he's Spider-Man as opposed to when he is. There's something special about that. I'm not equating us to anything like that. But anyway, a good origin story is definitely compelling. And all of us are sort of searching for that like little piece of magic we can find in ourselves in the origin story, right? No matter what domain it happens to be, business or anything else. So for us, it was a winding path, I will say, that got us there. And serendipity just sort of brought everything together at the right time. So I, at Carlos's previous company, he had a Facebook ad agency. And one of his first client is actually now our COO, Stephanie Fox, who's fantastic. And they were mainly focused on Shopify ad placement, you know, that sort of thing. But we started to hear rumors of people having a lot of success on Amazon. And at least it just sort of like sparked up the idea of like, maybe there's something there. Carlos and I had been fiddling around with some just straight Shopify brands, all which I, looking back, geez, who knows if they would have done anything or not. But we were going to do a luxury pillow brand and a sunglass brand. And we had a couple other things in play. And, you know, Josh had been talking with Carlos too for quite some time about doing a roll-up of some kind. It was very undefined. So what happened was among these conversations is I would go over to Carlos's house a few days a week and we'd have a couple glasses of wine and just sort of talk about stuff. And then Josh and Carlos would talk and we started bringing Stephanie into the fold. And at some point, this idea just sort of emerged of like, well, maybe we should try this with Amazon businesses, the roll-up concept, because no one's really done it before. So we're actually in the same week, going back to 2017, when I first opened up my computer and Googled, how do you buy an Amazon business? Because there was no established real marketplace for it, just sort of like a disparate group of brokers. And from there, we had a thesis in place. Josh and Carlos had access to capital, including some of their own. They put into the business to get us started. And we were kind of off and running with our first thesis, which was wrong looking back at it. But as soon as we sort of recalculated and put ourselves in a path forward, our next few choices that we engaged in as far as acquiring brands really worked out. And that just created this sort of like snowball down a mountain type momentum that was unstoppable, right? Because we had something that was very unique in a lot of senses. There was a completely immature M&A market for these businesses that no one really in the PE world had any idea really what they were about or what type of money they were generating or anything of that sort. It was just sort of this mystery thing. So you had all of these people who had Amazon businesses bootstrapped, 2 to 3 people, maybe a couple of VAs over the Philippines, something like that, who had grown their businesses so incredibly fast that in order to keep up with their growth, they had to spend all of the money they've made and put it back into the business. So creating this like endless feedback loop of stress, because you go from $10,000 a month to $50,000, $100,000 a month, you have to keep up with your growth on the back end. So it creates like immense stress where some people literally who we purchased from were looking to make an extra $40,000 a year, all of a sudden had $5 million a year businesses. Oh. And they're like, I don't know what to do with these things. Or I've taken it as far as I could go. And so there was tremendous opportunities to buy at low multiples and for us to sort of learn on the job. And that's really how it started. Well, you know, from the long and the short of it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I just want to bring one more point. You said a private equity, because I get a lot of questions around, do you think these roll-up companies will eventually become a private equity company and start selling businesses when they're not successful? What are the key differentiators do you see between private equity business buying, you know, doing something similar but not working on back end, and a roll-up company?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we were very cognizant of was that in order for this to be successful in any sort of long-term capacity, we needed to be very sound operators. And Amazon, while very simple on its surface, is immensely complex on the back end. So you really need to have very specific expertise in every domain across Amazon. That's like knowing how to deal with the back end and the flat files of Amazon, knowing how to build listings correctly, optimize your packaging, PPC, SEO, outside traffic, general Amazon expertise. Like all of this stuff can have profound impacts on your business. I can give you sort of like a very specific example. You do something that's not compliant for Amazon. It's an innocent mistake. Or maybe you have a bad actor who attacks your listing by claiming you're doing something wrong when you're not, right? Maybe it's a safety complaint. Let's say that. So that happens. If you don't know what you're doing, which we didn't in the very beginning, you can have an ASIN or an individual product SKU go down for 30 days, 60 days. I think our record was 54. Now, imagine that. Like, imagine a world where like you just purchased a business, paid a lot of money, your investors are wondering about your performance, and your number one product is now not selling for 2 months out of the year. It can create a real problem. Now, that might be a slightly hyperbolic example of what can happen. But the reality is that a lot of people in the PE world, they know the PE world very well. But do they know how to operate on Amazon? And do they understand the very complex nexus that sort of surrounds being a good Amazon operator?
Got it. And do you feel that Thresher is going to be just an Amazon expert? Or would you consider, are you growing into more omni-channel experts as well?
Certainly, we know the future will be multi-channel capabilities. The core of our business for now is still reliant on Amazon and will be. It's a very scalable model in a direct sense. We also know that a good portion of our portfolio will really only be appropriate for Amazon. Direct-to-consumer, Shopify-type products, they need a certain type of magic that's different than what an Amazon product needs, and retail is the same. But we do know there's a large portion of our portfolio that's juxtaposed to that really could do amazingly well in a retail setting or overseas or the Shopify site and so on and so forth. So what we're really doing is building out our capabilities to run a very sound D2C operation that can manage a bunch of brands that have a big retail program that can take on tons of SKUs and run them into traditional retail, brick and mortar. And we're going to sort of marry all of those things together and then scale from there. What we're not going to do is force a one-size-fits-all shoe on every one of our brands. It's rather just being selective.
That's awesome. And why is this roll-up businesses in major rise? I mean, I see that grow all over North America. Now I've started seeing companies in India and Singapore, even in Germany, is coming up quite rapidly. And again, the way they're working is almost like a Silicon Valley valuations. Why is that happening?
One of our investors said it best recently. I don't remember which one it was, that Thrasio is no longer a noun. It's also a verb. It's sort of like, we're going to be the next Thrasio of this roll-up or that roll-up. The reality is that like success begots copycats.
Sure.
You know, you have McDonald's, then you have Burger King next, then you have Wendy's next, then so on and goes on down the line. You have Ford, then Mercedes, and blah, blah, blah. That's the natural course of business. When people see something that works, they try to replicate it. How high resolution those replications actually are sort of remains to be seen, right? But we fully understood from the get-go that while we might be the emergent leaders in this space, that there were going to be other people eventually trying to do what we do and at scale. I think, though, that the sort of gold rush that we've created has perhaps led to the potential for some sloppy work as far as our competitors are concerned. And some of it's just because of the speed. There was so much money thrown at this particular niche so fast. So many people getting access to this capital with varying degrees of operational competency. So for me, and by the way, just maybe even common sense M&A thought processes from an Amazon perspective, which is very nuanced too. In some ways, they're very predictable businesses, in other ways, they're really not. So we were aware this was happening. It's sort of unfolding in a way that could be expected. I can't give you a total prediction of the future for this, but I think in the next year or so, we're going to likely see some sort of shakeup in the industry. I'm just, you know, you get phone calls at our scale and you put your ear to the ground. Some people are going to be very successful at this more than Thrasio. And for us, that's actually great. You know, for our valuation and for trust in this industry, we want people to succeed at this. And there's room for more than one of us at the dinner table. So for me, that's something. But I do worry about some of these other businesses that try to get into this thing and maybe got into it just a minute too late. And timing in life is everything. You have to understand, when we got into this business, the multiples that the market rate for businesses was significantly lower than it is now.
So
imagine this, like we had really low multiples. We had almost a non-existent competitive landscape, right? So we were paying a small price for things because there wasn't a market for it. That allowed us to have a lot of forgiveness on the operational side. Well, we learned everything. Then we learned everything. Multiples started going up, but because we had already shown success, we were able to get our interest rates down for the money that we loaned. Right. So it created, as things go up, we still have this sort of like wiggle room. Now you have scenarios where multiples have doubled, in some cases tripled from when we started. And you have these companies coming in, zero experience. Their interest rates are up here. What the multiples they're paying are up here. They have limited experience and zero wiggle room as far as their performance goes. It creates a pretty, let's say, stressful environment for those entities.
I mean, as long as you keep them, they'll be happy.
Yeah.
Now, on the talking about this SMEs, you know, how are they reaching the highest potential by being with Thrasio? So, what is that you're doing differently than rest? I definitely got one of the point that you are an expert on Amazon, but I'm quite sure it takes more than just being an expert on Amazon to get that, you know, the whole bottom line reduced to make some money out of those products.
Sure. Now, I mean, for us, there's a lot of things that go into being a real Amazon operator. And again, it goes back to operations. We know how to operate, right? So we know how to maintain things that are successful, and we know how to grow things that are emerging. And that's really what it comes down to. And those are some universal factors. You better know how to read the tea leaves within the Amazon ecosystem to know how to optimize your pricing and discount strategies, your PPC strategies, your inventory strategies, your brand presentation in comparison to everyone else in your space. All that has to be in harmony in order for you to have long-term success. And then the real Thrasio differentiator perhaps is also understanding all of the outside factors that can also have an impact on Amazon. So are you good at affiliate traffic? How is your Google PPC? Do you know how to run direct consumer? Do you have outlets for retail? Do you know Instagram? Do you know TikTok? Is it applicable for your brands? Do you know how to run good Facebook ads? All that stuff becomes a factor in securing positive outcomes for any given Amazon brand. And that's what we've done, is built expertise in all of those domains. So we have all the tools at our disposal to give an incoming brand the best shot for success.
And does Thrasio has a quite long checklist of companies you would actually go and help to grow, or is it if they want to come and approach you, you'll basically get them in?
Yeah. So our acquisition model used to be that we were all outreach in the very early days. No one knew who we were. So we had to go and introduce ourselves to as many people as possible. There was a dealer network that was still in existence today, but it was most prominent in the space. As we've grown and our reputation has increased, and you know, our things like this and our relative press has increased in its prominence, more leads now come to us than the other way around, which is generally a good sign. We even have some customers, sellers who've sold a business to us and then come back a year and a half later and sold a second business to us, which to us is the sign that you're doing things right.
And how is the evaluation process for you, especially in COVID, where let's say the travel is not happening? How is that done right now?
You know, I think what we do is we try to have a common sense approach to it. We don't want to deal like the ideal deal that comes through is when both sides kind of feel like they've won and not dominated, but they both feel like they got a fair shake, right? There's something like that. And for us, we want the same thing. So if we saw, let's say we had a suitcase brand, just make that up right now. Yeah. And during the really hard times of lockdown, their sales were down 40% from the year before.
Yeah.
Now we might still value it on today's numbers, say it's like, you know, that 40% lower number, but we'd make a bet that the rebound is likely to happen sometime soon. And we'd structure a deal so the seller who sold to us got a good portion of that upside to make up for their lost ground. So, and the other thing is adversely true. I'll give you an example that was just hilarious to me. In the UK, we still have a jump rope brand, right? It's the number one jump rope in the UK. I think I want to say it did like, you know, 1400 pounds a day in sales, something like that, right? As soon as the lockdown happened in England, like within a week on the first go around, one day the jump rope did 100,000 in sales.
Inventory-based success.
100 times X. Like, so obviously if we were to buy a business like that, we would look at those outliers and say, well, your real value is not that. You got this wonderful pop and good for you. But we're going to have to set some realistic expectations as to what you have and what you don't have. And the future now, I think all of the COVID stuff, as far as performance go, has more or less leveled off. And things are in some ways back to normal, you know, besides delays, let's put that stuff aside, but actual consumer behavior. So we would look into that. And we also look at things too. It's like, well, how secure is your supply chain? Is it super complex? Do you have 40 different suppliers building your 15 different things? Are they capable of scaling the business? That's a big one for us.
Yeah.
Right. Or if not, like how long will it take us to transfer over to someone who is? So there's a lot of factors in there to consider.
Awesome. I mean, just because, I mean, you said the suitcase and the jump rope, but can you share more seller success stories where, you know, basically the sellers really had a major result impact that's seen in a very short period?
Sure. Yeah. I'd say we've had a lot of those. And what it really comes down to is just the basic limiting factors of life. A lot of these brands are run by really smart, ambitious, entrepreneurial people, all of whom have limits as to what they are good at. So we've had people who've brought us a really great product, but they'll tell you right to your face, I'm not a marketing guy. I'm not a branding guy. I don't know pay-per-click advertising very well. And so we can take something like that and recreate it to something else entirely and make it huge. So one of our famous stories is a brand called Angry Orange, which back in the very early days, like I helped put the deal together for, sell it. And I was the one who was like, we need to buy this thing because I saw that branding and marketing future. I believe when we purchased it, it was doing well under $2 million a year in revenue. And we're just south of 40 this year as far as the run rate goes for the brand. So and next year, we expect to be a lot more. So those are the types of things that can happen. Obviously, it doesn't happen with every brand. But people will bring you something that's been successful, but it's not a full completed puzzle piece yet. And we're there to sort of complete the rest of the puzzle when things go well. And that's what we have, where we get a lot of success. We do a lot of deals too, where we pay a good amount upfront for the business, but then we allow the seller to ride with us as we try to grow the brand. So they'll get payouts for a few years after the brand has grown. So in the case of Angry Orange, the guy did very well, better than he thought he was going to do because we grew the brand exponentially. It's also a nice litmus test for us to understand what the seller thinks of the future of their brand. If they're not willing to leave a little bit on the table for a year or two afterwards, well, maybe they're not telling us the whole picture of what they have.
Thanks for sharing. On just on that front, you know, is there a kind of any kind of tech involved where it helps you, you know, kind of put a calculation in place where, you know, you just evaluate, you know, put the things, tells you, okay, this is the company you have to buy, or is it more gut to gut based feelings? So just want to understand if there's any structure in place for you to go and evaluate those companies, and maybe, you know, those companies can kind of look into you, you know, a pre-owned evaluation form, understand. And this is actually a question asked to me because, you know, I was talking to a roll of companies that, you know, is there an evaluation form where they can see if they're eligible for applying or even talk to those companies?
Sure. Well, we have, you know, basic parameters of what we like, and we do have a mixed set of tech resources that help us analyze businesses we're looking at or prospects. There still is really a human element to it though. So we have people now at an organization, including myself, and I can think of 10 other people who've literally looked at thousands upon thousands of these Amazon businesses. And at some point you just kind of know, like you just kind of know what you have. And it's this, for me, it's this flash of knowledge that comes together in like a 3-second period. Right. I'll look at something, I'll read the P&L for a minute, I'll look at the listings, and I know exactly what the business is and what it isn't. And I think that human touch will be hard to replace. Because you have to know, like, you know, does this product look like it legitimately belongs here? Or did someone do something untoward to get traffic and get it here? Does it work? Do the reviews feel really real? How is the branding presentation? What's their marketing spend percentage? What's the seller's history as far as the type of businesses they've run? And you can build this pretty specific mental picture of what you're likely going to get when you get it. And you then layer that on top of some really good data points that show where the market itself is going beyond that particular brand, where interest is shifting, and where competition is moving. And then you can make a pretty good picture of like, yeah, this is something we should probably buy or not.
Very much a Mark Cuban of Shark Tank. Exactly what you said.
Yes, exactly. Something along those lines, yeah. You know when you see it, good and bad, you know it when you see it.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you get a very short time to kind of make that, but if you have a gut feeling, you're just going to go with it. So awesome. Now, what do you think the e-commerce landscape is going to be? I mean, if you can kind of give a picture right now, what do you think the e-commerce landscape is right now, and, you know, what it's going to be in 10 years, especially more on the, you know, the spend wise, the amount of buyers and sellers, and what would be the role of companies look like?
Couple things. I think that we saw a decade of e-commerce growth during COVID. In a 2-year period, maybe even more. It now is in the, you know, we're in the 20s as far as the percentage of total retail. I think that will continue to sort of move in that pattern where we'll get closer to 50-50 in the next 10 years. I don't think we'll get there in 10 years, but we'll get closer. So there'll be a much larger pie for people to go get their slice of, which means there'll be a lot more players in every domain entering the e-commerce space. That's the good news. The bad news is that things like Amazon are following what every other successful marketplace or place to sell goods sort of pattern that happens, which is margin compression. Advertising gets more expensive, you know, like proper placement on where you want to be in the marketplace gets more expensive. COGS go up. Competition gets more severe and spread out. So you get price compression and it becomes harder, right? So I think we're going to see that is that you're really going to have to be a keen operator in order to have as much success as you want. That being said, for people just starting out, there's tons of room in little niches. And that's something that an entity like Thrasio, it's hard for us to compete on those really in the minutia. It's just, it's not necessarily worth our time. Whereas if I was just a single person entity, it might be worth my time to understand the 20,000 different varieties of toilet gaskets that I could sell and differentiate and make a really good living off of. Actually, know someone who's built a great business doing that. Exactly. Right. So those opportunities will always be there. We'll continue to march towards convenience, where other non-traditional marketplaces will probably take up a little bit more market share. I'm talking about shopping on TikTok and Instagram and other places like that. I think we'll continue to spread. And I think Amazon's one of those things that is just ingrained in the psyche in a lot of countries, particularly in the United States. And it's just so easy. And it's the type of place where, you know, you can just get almost anything you want instantly. And that's a hard thing to replicate. So I think the success of Amazon is we haven't reached the top there yet as much as it might feel that way.
I think, the last 5 years was all about reaching the audience for them to really buy it. And I feel now there are far more major audience who are capable to go and buy online. But do you feel there is a space where the products are being able to deliver to other places? Like, you know, when you go far further east or far further, towards the Africa, that's a big market as well. Eastern Europe, big market as well. Do you see that transportation is there, the operational cost is there, or is that what it's going to take in the next 10 years to get the operation and transportation right?
It's interesting that, you know, each region comes with a tremendous set of challenges and really differences on philosophy of commerce and behavior patterns of consumers and capabilities of distribution. You know, like if you just look at the difference in, say, like a country like India in the United States, how challenging distribution can be and how many hoops you'd have to go through to execute on all of these little towns that are popping up that have over 1 million people in them. You know, like it creates an entirely different set of challenges. So a plug and play Amazon ecosystem might be too much of the squeeze wouldn't be worth the juice, perhaps, where someone else might dedicate everything and understand that ecosystem and have the distribution already and find a way to be more successful in a nuanced marketplace like that. So I think the e-commerce replication of what Amazon is doing to some degree will occur, and Amazon will be very successful as they have been in a lot of places. UK's done tremendously well. Germany's done exceptionally well. Japan has grown tremendously. Other markets are like have some imprint on the culture, and other places will have other options. Yeah, there's successful marketplaces in South America, particularly in Eastern Europe, that's growing. Emart, I believe, it's growing, you know, very fast.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how the whole thing plays out, because it really comes down to, like, can you get the customers, the population, to buy into the habit that exists in the United States, which is like you're in your kitchen, you look at your spatula and you're like, this is a worn out piece of crap. I need to buy a new one. And I go right to my phone while I'm cooking and order a new one. And I don't look up spatula on Google. I go right to Amazon. Can we replicate that sort of process, or can Amazon do that in other domains? It's be interesting to see.
So you'll be rooting for Amazon to be successful and kind of in all those places. So once they are there, you know, basically it's easy for you to kind of start reaching out to those markets.
Yep.
That's great.
And I think there's room for other providers too in marketplaces that can be successful as well.
Yeah. Now, you know, talking about sustainability, this is one topic we kind of bring in almost all our podcasts. Is there something you are addressing right now, or do you think it's too early to keep that in agenda?
I don't think it's ever too early to delve into what your capabilities are to optimize those sort of things. I know that we have an internal committee at Thrasio that's working on that as a future guidepost for us to sort of aim towards. And we're already making some changes. It's incredibly complex because when we take over a business, we're also taking over their individual supply chain. So to create uniformity across that will take years for us, which is why we're starting to prepare for it now. Not saying we have all the solutions for it, but it's certainly something we're cognizant of.
And just so our audience knows, Amazon has came up with their own sustainability practice forms, which companies can follow. Do you kind of tap into that as well, or you're creating your own internal sustainability policies?
I think it's certainly something that we'll consider. Again, this is not my domain, so I don't want to overspeak for something that I'm not really participating on a daily basis. But we do have plans and certainly things we've already put in place to make sure that the manufacturers we select are treating people in an ethical, moral way, that we're working towards more efficient and sustainable ways of moving goods back and forth and storing them and doing all that stuff. So we certainly know that that selfishly will be an expected behavior anyway for any large corporation in the future. So whether you want to or not, in our case, we do want to, you have to start making those steps forward in order to have long-term viability in today's world.
Perfect. Now, when I'm talking more about talent, my first question there is, what are the skills required in Thresher to be successful? So, what are the skills which is already available within Thresher, which you think is making Thresher what it is right now?
Sure. We've always been a company that follows that sort of old adage that culture eats strategy for breakfast. So when we started this, we had no idea how big this would become. I think we had an idea that we were onto something special and that we'd have a really cool business and we could have a ton of fun doing it. And all of us had been in different businesses before, start them before, and had varying degrees of cultural differences as far as the business culture goes. But we decided very early on that we wanted a place that was fun, that was irreverent, that a place where you could tell the truth, not be ashamed of mistakes, be a fail-forward culture, assume good intent of those around you, and to build a place where people felt like they were cared for, that they were easily forgiven, that they were allowed to have fun, that they were allowed a certain amount of autonomy to go out and figure out what was best way to accomplish their goals. And we didn't want to build a place that had tyrants in the waiting, people who were obsessed with power or titles or political influence, the type of people who would sort of like climb over someone else in order to the crab in the bucket scenario. We wanted the exact opposite of that. So we really tried to build a place that was more about the we than the me. And we wanted a place that was fun, right? So if you have a fun working environment, then people feel a certain level of affection. And that affection makes them more loyal to the mission and what you're trying to accomplish, and more loyal to the people around them. And then they tell their friends at a cocktail party or whatever that, hey, I'm working for this great company and geez, we have a real blast there. It really is a cool place to work. And a lot of that other BS that I dealt with my last job is not here. So we really set out on a mission to have that be our reality. Now, as we scale, that becomes harder and harder to replicate over and over and over again, as the individual, again, is responsible for the culture. But it's certainly something we really still strive for. And I think Danny and Carlos in particular have really taken that original ideal that we had and are still pushing it forth in our culture. And to me, that's the thing I hope we can maintain the most. Forget about any of the financial metrics. The journey at Thrasio for me and for the people that I've been working with close with from the beginning, it's been such a fun and joyful ride. Has there been a ton of stress? Has there been a ton of work? Of course, absolutely. Yeah, we're building this crazy thing that's going to be a ton of work. But is it something that I dread, showing up to on Monday morning, virtually, whatever you want to call it? No, it's the exact opposite. And in order for a place to be successful, you need to have a culture that's healthy. You need to be able to identify people who aren't cutting the mustard when it comes to satisfying the needs of your culture. And even if they are good, finding a way for them to not be a fit anymore. Like there's something about that too, is it okay if I curse here on this podcast?
Yeah, of course. We have,
I mean, I do it like 1,000 times a day, so I'm surprised I've done it already, but you know, we have a policy that says no assholes.
Right.
It's one of our first like key tenets, and we really mean it. So it's something that I'm immensely passionate about and am very cognizant as we move forward to try to make sure that we continue the tenets of what made it such a happy place to be a part of.
Got it. Now, just to continue to that point is, you know, what are the soft skills that you look for while hiring, and what are the hard to find technical skills? You know, they're so niche that it's really hard where, you know, if our audience is interested and they have those skills, they can apply.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the soft skills, there's a couple of things that we sort of, you know, put a notch up higher than maybe other places will. Mm-hmm. I love a failed entrepreneur who tried something, ran something, got some level of success, and for whatever reason, ran out of money. There's a thousand reasons why a really great person cannot reach the success they wanted. Bad market fit. But those are the type of people who seem to have that joie de vivre and that sort of that essence of positive risk taking and creativity that allow for future success. So we look for people like that. We look for people who have grown teams, not taken over a team that was already built, but really have built things themselves. We look at people who've made really wise creative choices and companies they've been at before, where they were the catalyst behind a creative change that led to something that was really successful. We also look for people with very specific levels of expertise on very niche things. And we have tons of openings on our website right now. People can look if they want to fill those very specific needs. And we look for people who are willing to join something that is ever evolving and ever changing and in a constant state of positive chaos. So like, you know, if people out there are looking to sort of just like sit down at a desk and have the same thing happen every day, Thrasio is probably not the best fit for them. But if they're looking for some level of disruption, some positive risk-taking, they like collaborating with teams, even if they're just starting out and they just want to try something and get their feet wet and learn, we're there too. But those are some of the core tenets that we look for. And also too, now as we grow, people have experience managing people successfully.
Awesome. What do you wish that you knew? What you know now, you knew when you started?
Oh, I know so little still that I could really take this almost anywhere, to be honest with you. I think for us, it's really, I'm always a forward looking person. So for me, looking back to find that one specific thing, I think things fell into place for us beautifully. If anything, as crazy as it may sound in the early days, perhaps we should have been even more aggressive. And considering we're one of the fastest growing companies ever, that's a weird thing to say.
Yeah, that's true. Very, very true. Though.
But I think we had some misses early on where we were just like, things were just getting too scary too fast. And if I could go back, I would say like, don't worry about it. Let's just hire into it and figure it out. Other things too, is I would have spent more time focusing on building resources for the future that were outside of our Amazon expertise. If I could go back and be like, build your affiliate program, get a really great D2C people, figure out retail, invest in that now because you'll need it later. Because, you know, we're doing that now for the last year, but that means we had 2 years where we didn't really do it a ton. Right.
So you are a 4-year-old, $10 billion valuated startup.
Something like that.
Interesting. No, that's amazing. I mean, if you can take a few minutes and really just talk about Thrasio to our audience. And, you know, I mean, as I said, we have a large audience that have come from different groups. Many of them are basically product owners. Many of them are supply chain professionals. Many of them are basically interns who come out of this, you know, colleges and wants to know if they should go to big corporates or should they go in a kind of startup kind of setting. So would appreciate if you can kind of spend some time talking about Thrasher to them.
Sure. Even though we are ostensibly a large company now, we still have a lot of that startup vibe in us, which to me, if someone's interested in joining us, you sort of have the optionality of the best of both worlds. The security of something that is stable, along with a place where you can still have some fun and try out new stuff. So from that perspective, I think that it makes a very fun time to potentially join a team like Thrasio. From us, looking at the world beyond Thrasio, we see a world where lots of people can be successful. I'm happy for my friends in the space who are sellers when they sell to us. I'm just as happy when they get a great deal from someone else. I see this e-commerce and Amazon ecosystem only growing from here. And there's plenty of room for people to have really fruitful and wonderful careers in the space. So I like to think of Thrasio as a very giving place. We share ideas with people. We tell people how we got to success in hopes that they can find their own version of success as well. And we're not fixated on our competition. Rather, we're fixated on executing to the very best of our abilities. And I think that's another thing that makes our place special, is that really that essence that, we don't live in a fixed mercantile pie world. There's so much growth happening everywhere. And we want to help ourselves and others around us succeed to the best of our ability.
Beautiful, John. Thank you. Thank you, really. I really appreciate your time and candidness. And John, thank you.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For all the show notes and information discussed in the episode, please follow Elcott Global/podcast. Also, if you found this interesting, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any of the podcast platforms. We are looking forward to your feedback. Thank you so much.